5D3. Just giving a few paragraphs here because I'd like to start with a new subject. We got about as much out of the last one as I think we need to. We're starting a subject now, and you'll see that, as is not unusual in the Gemara, when you begin a subject, it begins the way the Gemara begins. It starts discussing some abstruse notion, and may frequently pose one abstruse notion against another. And one of the problems of studying Gemara is that when that happens, you assume that that's really important to deal with. And there are many who say that it is, except me. I don't think so. I think that it's important to sort of get the flow. You have to get into the flow, because that's the nature of the Gemara. The Gemara, you have to see where it's going. It's going somewhere. And so we can't get too hung up on the waves without riding the wave. So you'll see I'm going to push a little bit through this in order to make sure that we get on the top of the wave and we see where this wave is really going to. Okay, 5B3, on the left-hand side of the page, about halfway down in the Gemara says Gufa. If you're following in the Hebrew text, it's on Hey Amud Bet. It's about, I'd say three-quarters of the way down the page. You have it, Herb? Okay. And Meiri, you have it? You have the Gufa?
Yes,
Gufa. It says Gufa. Gufa. That's one of my... Okay, that's one of my favorite words, by the way. It's great because it really speaks to the nature of the Talmud that it's goofy. Okay. So... So you did know that goofy is an old Aramaic term. So the gufa means basically, when the Gemara says gufa, you know that it is going to be quoting something that was already said, either just said or probably said somewhat a while ago. Well, in this case, it turns out it was said so long ago, you may not remember it having been said. But we did study this. We studied it. And we'll just look at what it says. Gufa.
Is the gufa on Dafi Hay? On Dafi Hay? The gufa's on...
You're playing with me on my own game there. Right. It's goofy on Daffy Hay. Okay. All right. Amar Shmuel. Shmuel said, Shnayim shedanu dinehem din. Ela shenikra bet din chatzuf. Okay. This we had seen was quite a while ago. This was on Daf 3A. Just to reiterate what it says, we learned that a court has to be made up of three people. Then, for some strange reason, Shmuel said, Shtayim Shadanu, if there are two people who sit in judgment, and so you have suddenly a court of two people, Dinehem Din, Shmuel says that their judgment is valid. It's a valid judgment. Ela shenikra bet din chatzuf, but this court is considered to be an imperious court or a court with chutzpah. Chatzuf is chutzpah. This is a chutzpah de court. Okay. Why is it a chutzpah de court? Well, Shmuel takes the point of view that it is permissible to have a bet din with even one judge, or maybe two judges, but they don't need three judges. But that's from the Torah. And we had seen that there were a variety of ways of citing different Torah texts to prove one judge is enough. We saw last time that one judge was enough. Okay, so obviously there are some sources for that. So from the Torah, one judge is enough. But as far as the rabbis go, the rabbis must add to that. That was Shmuel's position. Because the rabbis will often create a reality, and it could be either a ritual reality, or they'll create a judicial reality, which then becomes the law. So even though, according to the Torah, one judge would be enough, or in this case, two judges would be enough, still you're chutzpahdik if you do something against the rabbis, because the rabbis set up three judges. So technically, whatever the judgment is made is a judgment. But you have not accepted the will and the wisdom of the rabbis. So it's chutzpahdik to do things like that. Okay? So that's the point of view of Shmuel. We have had that before. I've said this all before, if you remember it or you don't. And now we go on with that. Okay? So this is sort of the beginning. We're kicking off this wave. Yativ Rav Nachman v'kam l'hashmatata. Rav Nachman was sitting and was studying this learning of Shmuel. Right? He was doing that. Iteve Rabba l'Rav Nachman. So then Rabba says to Rabba says to Rav Nachman, he quotes a Mishnah to show that either, it's not exactly clear, either Shmuel is wrong, or Rav Nachman, who is sitting and, as it were, reading, but maybe arguing for this point of view, that he's wrong. Okay? So here we see an objection. So Rabba says the following, Eteve is an objection. Eteve is always an objection that is bringing a Tanaitic source to argue against an Amora. Shmuel was an Amora. He was an Amora. He's a Babylonian Amora. So now we're going to get a Tanaitic source that will be analyzed and will show that there is a good argument against what the Amora says. Okay? Afilu Shnayim Mizakin O Shnayim Mechavim. This is a Mishnah. It says, even were two to declare him not liable, or two to declare him liable, the echad omer eni yodea. Right, you have a court of three. So two are on the same side. Either they say chayav or zarkai. Right, either he's liable or he's not liable. So two agree. But listen to what the third one says. The third one says, the echad omer eni yodea. I don't have any idea. Okay? Now that's interesting. Because it's not as if he says, I think that he is not liable. And the two say he is liable. He says, I don't know. I just don't know. Okay? So, well, this is the question. You'll see what the Mishnah says about this. And the third judge says, I don't know. Yosifu hadayani. They have to add another judge. Because it's as if the third judge isn't there. It's as if the third judge is not there. Now that is to say, here you've got a Mishnah that says if you've got two guys and the third guy is, as it were, not there, they have to add another one. So how many do you absolutely have to have? You have to have three. You have to have three because we saw that two of them agreed. So obviously if two of them agreed, we would have thought probably that two is enough. Two is enough. And there is a third one, okay? But this third one is a peculiar kind of thing. He says, I don't know. So this is odd for us. We didn't exactly expect that. But obviously, it seems that two are not enough. Shmuel has just told us that two are enough. Here we have a Mishnah that is being analyzed which says two are not enough. So this is a good argument against Shmuel. Okay? What? Good question. I don't know the answer.
Well, because adding one won't change the verdict.
Well, they don't have to change the verdict. They just have to end up with a court of three. Okay? They have to end up with a court of three. They can't exist with a court of two.
So it's just because the third judge...
Well, of course, I guess here's the reason, right? Because let's say you add a new one. And he says... Any Odea. Alright, I don't know. And then what do you do next? You add another one. So that's why it says Yosifu Dayanim. Until you find a third judge who says either guilty or not guilty, you have to keep going. You have to keep going. Alright? Yes.
Is there any evidence that the judges were supposed to try to convince each other or that they each made their decision in total isolation?
They don't make their judgment in total isolation because they have to all be present together. They can't make a judgment in isolation. They have to actually be seated together. They have to look at each other. A lot of rules about how they have to participate with each other. They don't necessarily have to talk with each other. They have to be in each other's presence, and they have to all hear the arguments together. They can't do it separately.
I'm inferring the reason that somebody couldn't make up his mind, obviously, couldn't be engaging in trying to convince the others. So that was considered one of the elements.
Right. No, he wouldn't have to. That's not a key element in the process. Yes, sir.
So you're saying that somebody abstained,
correct, so to speak, he abstains. That's good.
Physically out of there.
So that he is considered, as far as the process goes, not there. That's exactly right.
For any reason.
Correct, exactly. For any reason. Even that he can't reach an opinion. Okay? So here in the context now, the context is that this shows that two are not enough. So this is a good argument from a Mishnah. It's very good to have an argument from a Mishnah. Because after all, Shmuel is an Amora. An Amora is an Amora. He's an Amora. One Amora can argue against another Amora. They can have two different opinions. That's reasonable. But if it can be shown that the Tanaim are all of one mind, and this Amora has an opinion that goes against that, he doesn't have a chance. He doesn't have a chance. Okay? So here we are. So now, of course, the Gemara women are in there. Rav Nachman comes and defends Shmuel's ruling. He comes and defends it. Shami Hatam. This Mishnah that you have just quoted, you don't understand it. It was dealing with a specific situation, and you're not taking that into account. Dimi ikara adata ditla to yetive. For from the beginning, right from the start, the judges originally convened with the intention of composing a court of three. That is to say, there was the assumption from the start, and it was agreed upon by all of the parties, that there had to be three. But had they not come to that, actually a verbal discussion beforehand, that they were going to accept and require the court of three, then it would have been okay to have a court of two. Right? So you just didn't know that about the case. But now that's at least what Rav Nachman says. Okay, so now the Gemara goes on and has another argument against Shmuel. Eteve, same kind of thing. You're going to have a Tanaitic source that will be brought to argue against Shmuel. Remember, Shmuel is saying that all you need is two. And your judgment is a judgment, even though it's a chutzpahdik judgment, because you haven't accepted the will of the rabbis. Okay, so here we'll see what the argument is. Now it's from a baraita. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel Omer. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, Hadin bishlosha. Okay. Judgment, having a court render a judgment of law. That's what din means here. It's a judgment of law. Bishlosha requires three. Ufishara bishnai. But a compromise can be reached with two. So, in other words, we're seeing for the first time here that there's a difference between a din and a peshara. There is a different law. The law, which is the law of din, requires shlosha, three. But not all matters are decided by matters of judgment, of the court coming down with a judgment according to the law. Frequently, you'll have two parties who are parties to, and they seek an adjudication on some matter of dispute, and it could very well be that the judge will say, we want to suggest that you try to arbitrate this matter. So that there's a question here about whether there's a difference between an arbitration and a matter of justice, of judgment. And there seem really to be two different ways to go about it. If you can achieve a compromise, that's a peshara, or we'll see that there's another term for compromise, which is bitsua. Both those terms of compromise, that only requires two. That only requires two.
I have a question.
Yes.
Unfortunately, this doesn't, to at least to this lawyer's ears, this sentence is really a non sequitur. It doesn't really make any sense, because to say, now the case of compromise is where the litigants agree to submit their dispute to arbitration. So in my world, arbitration has nothing to do with compromise. It's a different method of getting to a decision on the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear to me what Peshara is supposed to mean.
I think you're right, and it's not clear. At this point, I don't think it is clear, because we don't know why the number is two. And we'll have to keep that in mind. But just, I'm sure you have a sense that there's probably a meaning to the number two. Probably a meaning to the number two.
Like
we saw...
Like there was a witness.
Here you go. Here you go. So that part of it is, we're going to see that, we're going to get to that, where it is really, it's reminiscent of witnesses. And that there is... maybe in reaching either an arbitration or a compromise, even if a compromise, let's not use the word arbitration, just a compromise, as a matter of law, the question is, how do we make that valid? Two people can compromise, but is it then a matter of law? What makes it a matter of law? It could be that there are witnesses to it. That's not the only possibility, though. But it is a possibility.
Yeah, so they come to an agreement where they say, okay, look, you say I owe you, I say you owe me, we'll split it down the middle. You can do that with two people, and then there'll be some evidence that they reached a compromise.
Exactly.
That's one way to
exactly. Go. Exactly. Okay. Now, let's just go through the whole baraita, though. Let's start the baraita again. Rav Shem of Agami Olomer, Hadin Bishlosha Ufeshara Bishnaim. Yafeh koach b'shara mikoach hadin. Sheshnayim shedanu, and I translate, a matter of law is decided with three, a matter of compromise by two, and the strength of a compromise is greater than the strength of a matter of law. Why? Shishnayim shedanu, for if two were to adjudicate according to the law, balei dinin yicholin lachzor behem, the litigants could retract their agreement. Which is to say that two is not enough. That's really where we started with that. Shmuel said that two was enough. But here we see that it says in the Baraita that two are not enough because they can retract their agreement. Ushnayim sha'asu peshara, but if two are there, and we use the terminology, except for the moment, arbitrate a compromise, or they witness a compromise, ein balei dinin yicholin lachzor behem, then litigants cannot retract their agreement. Right, so we see that, in fact, two who are somehow empowered to be the key players with a compromise, in effect, are more powerful. Because it still becomes a matter of law, but this law is done by two. That law is done by three. If two can actually achieve something that the three in terms of what they usually do, you need three in another case, then the two, in a way, have more power. Now, it may mean that, or, let me give you another possibility. One of the thoughts that I have when I read this is that when you read, if you read the Hebrew of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, it's saying to you something else. On the one hand, we think that we're reading about the value of a court, people in the court, justice that is achieved by methods of the court, and so on. Here I have a feeling that what the Gemara is really trying to do is to introduce something entirely different. Which is to say, don't think that the law is always the place to go. sometimes it's really better to compromise. Here you go. I think that is the force of the way in which the wave is beginning to gain its energy. The energy here is really moving us toward the value of a compromise. And that's maybe a legal matter, it may not be a legal matter. It has to be a legal matter. Any court, let's say, has to have procedures for compromise. At what point, for example, can you compromise? The Gemara, you'll see in a while, will define the fact that you can't compromise after a certain point in the adjudication. For example, after the judge has brought down the verdict, you can't at that point say, I think we could find a compromise. I bet that's the way, is that in the American system the same thing?
No.
You can always compromise?
Well,
even
you
after
can
the
have to the verdict before you give up a right of appeal, and you can still...
Oh, and that's interesting. So in other words, if you give up something, you can still resort to the compromise? Very interesting. So you give up the right of appeal, you say.
Right. You say that there is a verdict, uh-huh, and parties get together, and they don't want to go through the appeal uh-huh process, so they compromise on what that verdict
is. I see.
On the amount of the verdict.
Very interesting. Well, that's interesting, because in Jewish law it doesn't work like that. In Jewish law, as you'll see in a short while, there is a potential problem with a compromise. And that is that there's a very good chance that one of the litigants is right and the other litigant is wrong. Okay? They're not both right. One is right and one is wrong. And therefore, if there is a compromise, while there is a good side to it, there's also a bad side to it. And that is that somebody may be losing something that is coming to him simply because he's decided to compromise. Okay? So it's not so clear that it's always the best thing to do. And to the contrary, since also the source of the law is a divine source of the law is assumed to be just. And if you are going to go around the justice of the law, in fact, you are spurning the law and its just ends and rewards by the fact that you are deciding to do it another way. So that's the tension here. The other side of it is that it's much better not to litigate and to just compromise. Because that's the other side, which I think you're seeing here in the comment of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel. That's yafeh koach apshara mikoach hadin. Just, you know, on its own terms, that's what he's saying, I think.
Just a nuance that I think I'm reading in this, in these words, about retraction. It seems that the two who are doing a pshara, a compromise, just the fact that they did a pshara is binding.
Right.
And why is it binding while the others you can retract? Maybe because you are agreeing willfully and consciously,
mm-hmm,
and once you give your word, you don't go back. Whereas mm-hmm where it's a dayanim, they impose it on you.
Correct. That's
so
also,
it seems
that's
to me
true
that there's
an
emphasis on the two people who are doing the pshara,
yeah,
and once you decided that's what you do, that's it.
Right.
It's a moral living.
Yeah. I think that I want to take that last word you used, moral.
Yeah, it's a moral.
In a way, we started out assuming that this discussion is a discussion of law. But very quickly, what happens is that you get into a discussion of morals, which is not the same thing as law. And sometimes it may be that we feel that something that has greater moral, how can we say it, moral strength to it, should therefore be a better thing.
Integrity, strength.
Yeah, integrity, strength. Correct, correct. And the comments, yes.
When we did marriage, we just realized that it was a three-way contract, the bride, the groom, and God.
Right.
And I think in the same way, every dispute has three parties.
Mm-hmm.
The two that are in dispute, and God, meaning that there should be a just outcome as relates to God's law.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that every one of these has a potential impact on public, what I would call public policy.
Yes.
And if there's erosion of that by virtue of an agreement that thwarts that or is not consistent with that, it erodes the community.
Right. That's part of it. Yes.
What is the difference theologically between the law, morals, and ethics?
That's a simple question. That's a complicated question. It's a question that is posed the way you've just posed it. The first time it was posed was done by Plato in the Euthyphro. Plato poses this in his dialogue, the Euthyphro, which is essentially, can the law be unjust? And in theory it could be if it's the law. If you abide by the law has its value, its justification from the fact that it is a just application, or it is a proper application of the law. But it is also possible that it be immoral. Unjust is not the right word. Immoral. Could the law be immoral? Okay? And it's not an easy thing. I mean, it's a very difficult question. If you were... We talked about this a little bit when we were talking about Dostoevsky. I remember when that was. The last year, the year before, if you remember, we looked at the Grand Inquisitor section of the Brothers Karamazov. And that's also the question there. So it's not a simple question. And it's a question, one of my favorite, it's Justice Holmes, if I remember. Holmes says that, as a constitutional lawyer, he says that the law floats on a sea of ethics. The law floats on a sea of ethics. I always thought that was a very fine way of expressing the sort of interdependence between ethics and the law, morals and the law. But what Holmes is saying is that they're not the same. They're really not the same. They may try to be the same, but when it gets down to it, they're not necessarily always the same. There's a place for ethics that is, morals that is independent of law. Sometimes the law itself could be unethical. That's a big issue in the history of Jewish law and the way we think about it, but it's in any legal system. So it's not an easy question to answer. Yes.
Following up what Barry said, was thinking, if the law is part of just to God, then how can we have the earlier argument you just made about the two judges and the hypothetic court? That's a contradiction.
Well, the only way it wouldn't be a contradiction is if we accept the fact that God gives authority to the rabbis, right, and therefore respect of authority of the rabbis and their decisions is the ultimate way of respecting God. Okay? So, therefore, then the court of three...
The court of two
is okay because of the court of the Torah, and if you go to the court of three, even though you're abiding by strictly God's law, God also empowered the rabbis, and therefore, that's what's chutzpahdik. That would be the way to explain it. If we try.
It's a little complicated.
Yeah.
Well, if the law has divine origin, and the extent that something's unethical, it must be because of a failure of proper understanding of what the law is. I mean, because God's law can't be unethical, I would think. And in where they're I was thinking where they're talking about needing a third judge where one doesn't know, that in effect what you're doing is depriving the litigants of a third person to bring some sort of meaning to what the interpretation to the law.
Right. I think that's right. That's the way I would understand that. I agree with you. I think I agree with the analysis. And I also agree with the first part of what you said, that the law could not be unethical, except I will say that that's not everybody agrees with that by any means. If you want to read the best, here's the best argument I ever saw in the Jewish context for this. It's a book written by the Yiddish author, which is translated into English. Not a great English. English is not great, but it makes the point. It's good enough. I mentioned to you before the Yiddish author Chaim Grada, whose great masterpiece is the two volumes Yeshiva, the Yeshiva. Chaim Grada also wrote a smaller novel called The Aguna. The Aguna. And this is the subject of The Aguna. This is the whole subject. Because The Aguna is a woman who has every reason to be divorced and can't be divorced. So one rabbi says, well, we'll find a way in the law to make sure that she's divorced because it's only right, just, and ethical. And the other rabbi says, what right do you have to create that? The law itself is just and ethical. Even if she doesn't get her divorce, the law is just, and therefore she and you and we as the community have to be happy with it. It is greater, the greater is the happiness of knowing that we are doing what is just according to the law, because of course it's ethical even if you don't understand whether it's ethical. Okay? So it's a very hard question to really press, but a great author does it very well, and I recommend that. I don't know if we have it here in the library or not. These days, maybe you could even get it for the Kindle. I don't know. So Chaim Grada, The Aguna. The Aguna. Best statement of this question.
G-R-A-D-E.
G-R-A-D-E. G-R-A-D-E.
The original in Yiddish?
Excuse me?
The original
is in Yiddish. I believe The Aguna was translated also into Hebrew. Mm-hmm. I believe it's called Haguna in Hebrew. Haguna. But in English, it's also called the Aguna. Aguna.
By the way, in regards to Aguna, a woman that her husband died, or we don't know that he died, is Aguna too? So it's not only divorce.
Oh, it's definitely. That's the most common case, is what you just said. It's the woman
that we don't know about the husband.
We have no proof that he is dead. That's the problem. It's a problem of proof. If we could prove that he was dead, then there would be no problem. But we don't have proof. It's circumstantial. And as you said before, Shnai Nedin, you need two witnesses for all, the Chol Davar. You need two witnesses for every matter. And anything that is so significant as whether a woman is married or not, why is it significant? Because if she sleeps with another man, it's adultery. And that's prohibited by the Ten Commandments. And it's a death penalty. So we can't allow her to, you know, the law can't allow her to be subject to the death penalty. Right? So we have to make sure that she's not. That's why all these laws have such impact.
Going back to the Pshara, if two people decided to go the Pshara way, mm-hmm. they must have a Dayan, or two Dayanim, or three Dayanim, or they can do it with no Dayanim.
Well, all I can say is what we've seen, the Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, you need two Dayanim.
So even if I want to make a Pshara with...
Correct. You need two Dayanim. So and we, as we, as we said, it's part of this may just be, it's not that the Dayan, it could be several reasons why. Could be that the Dayanim will have a part to play to make sure that both sides are being just with the other. I mean, you can have one litigant who is more knowledgeable in the matter than the other, and therefore can be one of the parties could be at a disadvantage. So that may be one reason that you would have Dayanim. Totally different reason is that you might have just simply need witnesses.
So how the court sees the pshara outside, without the, how it's being, I understand.
Well, we can't have it totally without Dayanim. We need to have some context of Dayanim. Could be they arrive at this compromise outside, then they have to come before the two Dayanim, okay? And then it becomes, it ratifies it.
So why not one if they already agreed?
We don't know. We have no idea why it's two. We spent a lot of time seeing why you need three judges, and even there we're not sure you need three because we saw two and one also. So this is just brought as a fact, and it's discussed later in the Masach.
Practically, if you didn't have the two, they could spend a lot of time reaching agreement. They shake hands, everything is fine, they go away, and the other, and then one says, forget it.
Exactly.
So you basically need somebody to facilitate and write it in the court document that was the pshara.
You need to make it official somehow. You've got to have some process of making it official. And lots of possibilities, but you've got to have some process there. Let's keep going. Okay? All right, now we saw Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel was brought in order to argue against Shmuel, right? Because Shmuel says two is enough, and effectively Shimon ben Gamliel is saying that two doesn't work. It's good for Pishara, it's good for compromise, but it's not good for legal matters, for a matter of law. And here we begin to. And should you say that the rabbis argue with Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and maintain that a case may be decided even according to the strict law by two judges, the Hamar Rabbi Abau, but Rabbi Abau said, Shnayim shedanu ledivrei hakol ein dineihem din. If two adjudicate a case according to din, strict law, ledivrei hakol, everybody agrees, ein dineihem din. Their judgment is not valid. Okay? Since Rabbi Abau teaches that no Tana disputes Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's position, Shmuel has no Tanaitic support to justify his departure. Rav Nachman comes and answers, Gavra agavra karamit. Are you raising a contradiction between one man, namely Rabbi Abau, and the other, Shmuel? Shmuel disagrees with Rabbi Abahu, maintains that the rabbis do dispute Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's position and holds that the adjudication of a two-man court is valid. Shmuel may therefore side with the rabbis and rule that adjudication by two judges is valid. So in other words, it's just an agreement. They're just simply disagreeing with each other, and it's reasonable for two people to disagree. Okay, now we go back to Rabbi Abahu's position. And that's quote again as a gufa. A gufa, something mentioned before, and now it's going to be discussed by the Amoraim. Amar Rabbi Abahu, Shnayim shedanu dinei mamonot b'divrei hakol ein dineihem din. We've had this just above now. Rabbi Abahu says, two who make a judgment in monetary cases, and the assumption is here that we're talking about law, matter of strict law, strict law as opposed to compromise. The divrei hakol ein dineihem din. Everybody agrees that there is no strength, significance to the judgment that they arrive at. Now we get any teve. Same structure. We'll see now a baraita that comes to object to this. E teve Rabbi Abba le Rabbi Abahu. Rabbi Abba attacks Rabbi Abahu from a Mishnah. Dan et adin, if one adjudicates a monetary case, vizikat achayav, and declares the one liable to be, vizikat achayav, the one who is liable is declared to be not liable. Okay? Vichiev et azakai, and the person who is not liable is declared to be liable. So in other words, they do it wrong. Right? Whoever is guilty is declared not guilty. Whoever is not guilty is declared guilty. Right? So, dan et adin. Now, dan et adin, what's the number of people involved in the verb dan?
One person.
Dan et adin. At least that's how he's understanding it. If one adjudicated a monetary case, Vizikata Chayav, declared the liable to be not liable, or declared the not liable to be liable, Timeata Tahor, right? Something that was ritually pure, he declares to be Tameh, ritually impure. Tiherata Tameh, something that was Tameh, impure, ritually impure, he declares to be Tahor, pure. Okay? Masha Asa Asui, what is done is done. Umeshalem mi beito, and the judge has to pay. Right? It can't change the results, but if anybody has lost monetarily here, the judge is liable to pay out of his own pocket. Okay?
Creation point.
Well, we don't really know for this, because this is a Mishnah taken out of a totally different context. Right? So it's just lifted and brought here. The reason that it's brought here, out of context, is that we do see that there is one judge makes a mistake, and the crazy thing is, or the odd thing is, that it seems to say here, the judgment is a judgment. No, it's a valid judgment. It's not a perfectly valid judgment. There are problems because, remember, we already learned that in a proper court of law, judges are immune. They're immune. They're not liable. They're not liable. Right? So this is not proper. But it has some degree of propriety to it because it says the judgment stands. The judgment stands. The judge still is liable, so it's not exactly what it's supposed to be, but there is some degree of validity to it. So that's strange. So the Gemara has to deal with that. So it says, Hacha b'mayas kinin, what are we dealing with the case, right, as you asked before? What was the original case here? What was this really about? De kibluhu alayu. Oh, this was a case where the litigants accepted upon themselves the lone judge to hear their case. Right? This was, and we know that there's a point of view, we've already read that one judge is enough. Even though the rabbis say that you should have three, we see there's a point of view that says that one judge is enough. If the two litigants both say, and we also learn that the judge has to be a judge whose fame has gone out into public, okay, could be one of those judges also, right? Then it's okay. Ihachi b'ma mishalem mibeito. Well, if so, why does he have to pay? I just argued with for a minute here, saying that the Gemara is justifying. He says that there is a point of view which says that one judge is enough. Well, if that's true, one judge really is enough. Then why does he have to pay from his own pocket? Right? That judge also should not be liable. Right? He should have immunity. Well, the answer is the amru le dayant lan din Torah. Because the litigants can say to the judge, did you judge for us a Torah judgment? In other words, after the fact, they didn't decide this really ahead of time. They didn't decide ahead of time that the judgment would be what you call a Torah judgment. Torah judgment is based on one judge. And it would be truly a proper judgment. And in theory, it would be a proper judgment. And the judge would be immune. He would be immune from having to pay. But they never made this explicit at the beginning. They simply neglected to make this all explicit. And therefore, it's not such a clean case. Not such a clean case.
Who is judging the judges?
Who is
judging the judges?
Well,
deciding that the decision was wrong. And that the one found guilty is not guilty and the one found guilty.
Well, there could be either of two cases. Either the judge who made the mistake would realize that he made the mistake, or the litigants also, the one who was hurt by the matter, could bring it before another judge, and at least they would tell the judge that he made a mistake. Yeah, well, I don't want to use that word. I was careful not to use it because I'm not saying that there would be a second court that would overturn the first court, but certainly if there was an error, the second court could say, you made a mistake. Okay.
So I mean, wouldn't that be ubiquitous in any case, that the person who lost, who got the bad judgment would say, no, wrong.
But he could be wrong. He's probably wrong. We, generally speaking, the judges don't make such mistakes. Now, of course, we don't know, just as I said that, and as you read that, we don't know what it means to make a mistake. That's the next thing that Gemara is going to talk about. Because it says, well, what do you mean by a mistake? Is this a mistake which is just a basic error of fact or of law? Or is it a mistake of reasoning? No, we don't know what you mean when you say to make a mistake. That's exactly what the Gemara will now discuss. Because it wonders the same thing. Okay, so let's take that and let's keep going with this. It's sort of a little bit of a digression, but it's a natural one because you came up with it yourself. You wanted to ask that question. When it says that he made a mistake, what does it mean? What does it mean to say he made a mistake? And the matter is interesting. If what we mean by saying that he made a mistake is that he made a mistake in a Mishnah, that is to say, he simply didn't know what the law was. Right? The Mishnah, everybody knows what the Mishnah is. The judges are supposed to know what a Mishnah is. If a judge doesn't know what the Mishnah is, that's terrible. That would be a terrible thing. Bamai. If that's the case, if somebody makes a mistake with a Mishnah, then the whole thing is undone. Okay? Because that's simply a matter of the judge not having any idea what everybody's supposed to know. That's a matter of law. And therefore, what you remember we said before, that the matter stands, but the judge has to pay. Here, the matter doesn't stand. If it's a matter of Mishnah, it doesn't stand. Okay? He made a major error. Rather, he made an error in shikul hadat. Literally, that means weighing the opinion. Weighing the opinions. Now, the Gemara is going to explain what that means, because it's not clear what that means. Hechi dami b'shikul adat. What do you mean by saying weighing the opinions? Amarav Papa, kagon detrei tanai utrei amorai tifligi ahadavi. It gives us the following definition. Either we have two amoraim or two tanaim. Now, they've got to be. Here you have two opinions that are on the same level. So we're talking either two Amoraim are disagreeing or two Tanaim are disagreeing. We can't say Tana and Amora because the Tana would immediately take precedence. So two on the same level here are disagreeing. The lo itamar hilchata la kamar v'la kamar. And the law was never established in accordance with one master or in accordance with the other master. Right, so we don't have any case here of legal precedence. Right? There is no establishment of the law prior to this. V'sugyan di alma aliba d'chad minayi. But there in fact was a consensus to follow one of the opinions. V'az al ihu v'avad k'idach. This judge went in accordance with the other opinion. Hainu shikul adat. That's the problem of weighing the opinion. Okay? So in other words, this is a subtle, and I'm interested to know from you lawyers whether there's any precedent to this in American law. So it's not a matter of law per se where the law is written down. That's just a mistake, and if a mistake is made like that, then you have to undo whatever the results are. Here there's a much more subtle problem. This is a problem, and it's not a problem just of reasoning. Shikul adat doesn't mean reasoning. It means that the law was never decided, but generally speaking, practice followed one or another of the opinions. Right? And in fact, it became customary to follow that practice, even though it was never rendered as a matter of law. In that case, where suddenly somebody goes totally against accepted procedure, or the accepted way of understanding things, then in effect, the decision of the judge is a valid decision, but it's a problematic decision. So we have to have some recourse in a case like that. Okay. Is there any...
I don't think there'd be a distinction in our law between a, for example, piece of legislation, which is very specific, and then case law, which seeks to interpret that legislation. I think in both instances, if there's errors, then it would be reversed. I don't think there's that kind of distinction.
Let me just press that a second. Let's say you have case law. Particular question, and you have a certain period of time when all the cases have gone in a certain direction. Can a judge or a court that's on the same level, I can understand we're talking a higher level could undo something from a lower level. If you're on the same level, is there any presumption that you have to do as others have done before you, because that's simply how it's been done? Or are you totally independent to decide everything as if it had not been done before?
Precedent.
Well, what is the weight of precedent?
Right. I don't think it's binding precedent. I think that most of the time that would be what would occur, is that you do follow the law as it's developed. But if the judges are on the same level and there's no opinion from a higher court, I think that there are instances where a judge will disagree with what they think is a prevailing view if it's not decided by a higher court.
Interesting.
Well, you could have, say, let's take the federal court in New York.
Okay.
Right? So we have, where we are in Manhattan, let's say there are 30 district judges. And in the Brooklyn, Queens, Suffolk, there are 30 judges. So issues that have not been decided, that happens. Okay. So you could have a judge in the district court, that's the baseline court, makes a decision. And two or three other judges have the same issue. This happens not that infrequently. They're not bound. One judge of the same level is not binding on the other. So these judges now have to... So let's say you have four or five, and in Brooklyn they're making the same decisions, and six or seven are coming out one way, and one is coming out the other way. So there's a... This is your example. This is your hypothesis.
That's
a
correct.
Trend,
that's what,
and that happens.
Right.
I was victimized by that once. And so now you go... Now the cases, or one of them, gets to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals decides. That's binding on the district judges.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the scenario.
Right.
What happens? That, you know, sometimes you go back and you have to undo the wrong decisions.
When it gets to the higher court.
Yeah. Sometimes it's not retroactive.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, in my experience, first, I'm not a lawyer, but I get into court a lot.
You get sued a lot.
You get sued a lot.
Yeah, I get sued a lot, or I take it.
Oh, you sue.
Okay. But and you can correct me if I'm wrong. But a lot of decisions get made, you know, on a very low level in a civil court or a lieutenant court that you completely disagree with. But unless you want to spend the big bucks to appeal it, you go with the decision.
Right.
And it could be totally wrong.
Right.
The judge. I mean, these judges. They make up. You know, they make it up as they go along. Seriously. I mean, you have to be there to believe it.
Right.
And if you don't appeal it, it's not precedence, right? It's just a decision.
Right.
But in order to have precedence set, I think you have to take it to a higher court.
That's very interesting. Interesting.
You need to be rich.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Not on the second one.
Okay.
This is, so the force of, so when you say if the Tanaim, the earlier rabbis, have a rule, and if they've come to agreement, that's it. I mean, that's binding on the Amoraim.
Sort of.
Right. Okay.
Because what you could always say if you were an Amora was, well, that was true. It's absolutely binding. However, the specifics of the case, you didn't understand what the specifics were, and it is binding, limited to the specifics of that case. However, what they weren't considering was this following factor. That's how you undo it.
So
I'm sure it's still done the same way.
So that would make, that's good, because we have this view of the, you know, evolving. It's the responsibility of every generation to
keep the system evolving.
Yeah.
And that's what goes on here. Same thing.
Yeah.
It's really not static. It appears as if it would be static, but when you get down to it, the methodology is such that it always keeps moving.
So Jewish law doesn't build up on precedence?
Oh yeah, it has precedence. Definitely has.
But every generation can say, oh, let's tweak the parameters for the old case is not the same as here, so it's not. So
correct, and they may win and they may lose. Mm-hmm. It takes time for these things to work themselves out. The system of legal development doesn't happen in a few years and takes several generations, really, to know what goes on. The nice thing about a system like this is that it does happen over a long period of time. So you can sort of see something happening over several hundred years. It really works the same way in our system, I would imagine.
So you want and you need stability, and you want and you need the capacity for change.
Yeah, Hello. Both of them. Yes.
I guess the question that I had before is relevant. Is divine law purpose of it to have a just and moral and ethical society, or is it to prevent chaos?
Both.
So then the question, when we were talking about things evolving, okay, and how the law evolves, different generations, different times, and things like that, and yet we have absolute laws, divine laws, the one you mentioned before called adultery, okay, which was punishable by death, which evidently in ancient times was viewed as a much more serious thing than it is today. Okay. However, the divine law doesn't change.
The divine law what doesn't change?
Should have been changed. Should it have been changed?
Should it have changed?
Yeah.
I don't know. It depends on who you ask. Depends on who you ask. On that, I can assure you there would be a difference of opinion. Okay. Let's keep going. Where did we end up here?
Amar Rav Ashi.
Where is it?
We finished the weighing of opinion.
So, Hainu Shikoladat. Okay, 6A2. All right, now the Gemara then goes back to the issue of before, how many judges you need to adjudicate a case, all right? Because that's where we started out. Shmuel said two is enough. So we're going back to the same issue. Lema Ketanai. Let us say the point of dispute between Shmuel and Rabbi Abau. Shmuel says two, Rabbi Abau says you need three. Okay. But this goes back to a debate among the Tanaim. This is also a classic way of arguing. We have two Amoraim who have a different opinion. Could be that both of them are just carrying out a difference of opinion that existed among the Tanaim, the earlier generations, 200 and before. And here you see we're back to compromise. And here we see an argument among the Tanaim about what is called it's called Bitsua. Some call it Bitsua and some call it Pishara. It's translated in both cases as compromise. Undoubtedly, there's probably a difference between the two, but it's in the context here, it means the same thing. Bitsua bishlosha. Compromise must be arbitrated by three. We read before two. But here you're going back now to an argument among the Tanaim that there's a difference of opinion. We thought two, but there happens to be another opinion that says three. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's the opinion of Rabbi Meir. The Chachamim Omrim, the sages say, Pishara Biyachid. All right. You don't expect the Gemara to tell you what you think it's going to say. You thought it was going to say two. All right. We said one. Rabbi Meir says it's got to be three. And we expected the next one to say two. No, it's not two. It says one. Okay. So the Chachamim, the sages say, Pishara Biyachid. Sivaru, huh? They who likened this Tanaitic dispute to the one between Shmuel and Rabbi Abahu thought, the Chuli Alma Makshin and Peshara Ledin. Everyone agrees that we can compare the requirements of arbitrating a compromise to the issue of a matter of strict law. I realize we're talking now about compromises. Right? How do we know that you can find out either two, three, one, whatever it is, and learn from that about a matter of din, of law? We don't really know that. But the Gemara is saying that it appears, at least it appears for the sake of the Gemara, that they assume that it's the same in both cases. Now, of course, there's no reason to assume that, but that's what they're saying. That's being the assumption of the moment. My love, Bahaka Miflagei, is it therefore not on the following that the Tanaim disagreed? The Mar Savadin Bishlosha, Umar Savadin Bishnayim. It must be the difference then, that the difference is that one thought that the justices, you have to have three in a court, the other you have to have two in a court. First of all, how do you learn that from what we just said? First position was you have to have three. What was the second position? You have to have one. And now it comes and says, it must mean that some had the point of view of three and some had the point of view of two. Where did they get that from?
But maybe the two was distributed once I'm not here.
Maybe, but you can't.
The one was plural. That's so
weird. Okay. All right. So, well, it's not a very good argument. Not a very good argument. Yeah, it's a good joke, but not a good argument. So then, the best thing is what the Gemara now says, lo. It's not correct. It just doesn't make sense. Oh, the Kuli Alma Din Bishlosha. Everybody agrees that Din Bishlosha, that a matter of law, is in a court of three. Bahacha Bahaka Miflage, and here in the Baraita's case, this is what they're disagreeing about. The Mar Savar Makshin and Bishara Ledin. One master, namely Rabbi Meir, takes the point of view that we compare compromise to strict law, that is to say, three and three. Right? Rabbi Meir said you need three for a compromise, and we know that you need three for a court of law. Umar Savala Makshin and Bishara Ledin. And the other one says we cannot compare one to the other. It's just different. It's different there. Okay? Lema tlata tanai bipashara. And therefore, let us say that in the case of compromise, there are three positions. There are three possibilities. All right? Demar sava bishlosha. One possibility is three. Mar savar bishnayim. The other possibility is two. And guess what the last one is? Umar savar bi'achad. So now we have two possibilities. We see that there's a difference between din and peshara, between matters of strict law and matters of compromise. And we see that in matters of compromise, it could be three, it could be two, and it could be one. But the Gemara is saying, as far as the law goes, it's got to be three, it can't be two. Gotta be three, can't be two. Okay. Amar Rav Acha, Berev Rav Ika, Beitaymar Rav Yemar Bar Shalama, Mandi Amar Trei Afilu Chad Mami. The one, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, says that two judges are sufficient, agrees that even one judge is okay. How's that? The high, the Kamar Treis, and the reason that he says two, Ki hechi delei vuale sahade, is so that there would be witnesses to the details of the compromise. This is what Meir said before. He agrees that from a technical perspective, in order to make it valid, the Peshara, you could have just one. But you need two witnesses. So that's why he requires two. Right? It's not that really as a matter of law, but because, in fact, you combine two functions here. Something that validates the Peshara and something that provides for witnessing of it, therefore he says to. Okay. Let's go on. Amarav Ashi. Ravashi says, Shmamina, learn from this, namely what Rabbi Meir said, Bishara Eina Tzricha Kinyan. We saw that Rabbi Meir says that a Bishara, let's see, we quote him here, he says Bishara in three, right? Yes. Bitzua Bishlosha, Divrei Rabbi Meir. Compromise is with a court of three. That's sort of the position of Rabbi Meir. So Rav Ashi says, Shlomina, learn from this fact. Rabbi Meir says that a compromise as well has to be in a court of three. Bishara ina tzricha kinyan. You don't need an act, some act, that in fact validates the compromise. Now, what is he saying here? What we were saying before is, if we had a lesser number, would it have validation? Would it be acceptable? And we said, well, maybe you need two in order to have two witnesses. Maybe, and now we see the possibility that even one is okay. Well, perhaps one is okay, but you need some act to embody it, to transfer it. A kinyan is some act that takes place which validates it. Normally you will need some witnesses also who will witness the kinyan. For example, when you have we're going to sign a ketubah. Those of you who remember what it is to be at a wedding, when you sign the ketubah before the wedding begins, it's our custom is to do it before the wedding begins. In Israel, frequently they do it under the chuppah. But we do it before it begins. In order to sign the ketubah, you have to make a kinyan. You have to make a kinyan to validate the ketubah itself. Okay? Now, it's not just that the witnesses are there, but the ketubah becomes validated. What I have to do is I have to read the ketubah and make sure that it's correct. So you validate the ketubah. What happens is that the rabbi will take some matter. Sometimes in my wedding, the rabbi forgot to bring a handkerchief. The classic kinyan is with a handkerchief. So he said to me, do you have a pen? And I said, okay, I have a pen. I always carry a pen. So he made kinyan sudar with a pen. It's perfectly fine. So he took one side of the pen, I took the other side of the pen. Kosher. Right? We made a kinyan. So once the kinyan is made, then you have a valid, it has legal reality to it. But you need legal reality. Something has to transform a situation from being one that just is to being one that legally has significance. The kinyan does that. The kinyan will do that. So here, Rav Ashi is learning from the fact that Rabbi Meir says that if the shara, compromise, is done in a court of three, from that we're learning implicitly that you don't need a kinyan. Because once you've got a court of three, you're dealing in the big times. You're dealing with a regular court of law. Right? So then these other symbolic methods which show that this is in fact a legal reality that's taking place, we don't need, because we've got a real court of law. Okay? So that's the function here. So Rashi, go ahead. It is like a handshake, exactly. A kinyan has the same force as a handshake in those transactions where a handshake has legal significance. In the diamond business, for example. I know people have always used that as an example.
In business in general, it used to be a handshake.
Well, I know in the we had a congregant once. He passed on. He was in the diamond business. So he came to teach me about what it is to make a deal in the diamond business. The whole business functions on mazel bracha. You shake somebody's hand, it's a mazel bracha, and then your word is there's no way that you can go against it, or you are you're not really a dead man, because it's not the mafia. But you're ostracized. You are complete. It's impossible for you to function in this business world anymore. Okay? You must keep your word. But of course, you have to shake hands. There has to be a moment when, in fact, the deal has happened. And you know when that has happened. It's the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Of course, with a Kenyan, I know that I've heard it said that the handshake, for example, in English law, tell me, lawyers, what do you know about this? It goes back to the custom of daggers. Do you know anything about that?
You weren't armed.
You weren't armed, correct. You were not armed. And that was an acknowledgement of that fact. In Jewish law, what it is that in theory, there is a symbolic consideration for a contract taking place. It's something that doesn't necessarily have to have any value, so it's symbolic, but there is consideration. Something has to pass from the hands of one person to the hands of the other person.
Do you need witness for a Kenyan?
No, you don't always need witness for a Kenyan.
So it can be nulled
immediately. Can be what?
If there are no witness.
Correct, but
no,
it doesn't matter. Because sometimes what happens is that once you've made the Kenyan, for example, here in the wedding contract,
and you have the ketubah,
then you have the ketubah, that has to have two witnesses. But the Kenyan itself doesn't have to be witnessed.
It's part of the process. Too.
Exactly. You can have it. Eventually it becomes key in the process.
So the Kenyan is not the deal.
The Kenyan is not the deal, correct.
The deal.
Exactly. That's correct. It allows you to get to the deal in that particular case. Okay? Very good. Okay. Pisharai Natsika Kenyan. The Isakadatak Srika Kenyan. Were you to think that a compromise required a symbolic action that required a Kenyan? Lemanda Matrika Plata Lamali. What do I need three judges for? Okay? Three judges make it really official. Alright? Tiske Bitre. It would have been enough to have two judges. Alright, we would not have two judges if a Kenyan were relevant. Lik nemine, and let the litigants make an act of Kenyan. So, it would have been enough to have two judges, and then you'd have a Kenyan in addition to the two judges. So the fact that Rabbi Meir says three judges, by implication means that there's no need for a Kenyan here. Okay? The Hilchata, the Gemara now concludes, when it says Hilchata, we learn what the law is. Hilchata Pisharat Sricha Kinyan. Compromise requires an act of Kinyan, even if arbitrated by a court of three. Okay? Of course, we don't know why. But that the Gemara simply comes and tells us that that is the law. And immediately you begin to get the sense that a compromise is just different from a court judgment. Compromise really is different. It's an arbitration procedure, and the rules, the details of the rules are going to be different for the context of a compromise than they will be for a matter of law.
Well, maybe it's because it's an involuntary thing. It's kind of another indication of the voluntary acceptance
agreement. Correct. That's correct.
Because the compromise...
That's right. Exactly. It immediately is voluntary.
So, I mean, first you have to agree that you accept
correct.
It, and then you have to show that you didn't accept it.
Correct. In the way, as we said before, you're actually creating something that's not in the law. The law itself, or we'll wonder whether the law itself, is this contrary to the law to get involved in a compromise? Because had it been strictly a matter of law, the whole development would have been different. The process of the Gemara would have been to show, well, the Torah says that you can do it this way, and here's the proof in the Torah. We saw no text at all. There's been absolutely no citation of text as far as this goes. And in a way, we're hungering for a little bit of text here, because it seems like you're going around the law. Okay? Correct. Yes, there would be. Yep. Let's keep going. I want to get to one place that this is going. You'll see it shortly. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a breita. Kishem shahadin bishlosha, kach bitzua bishlosha. As a judgment in a matter of law is adjudicated by three, kach bitzua bishlosha, so compromise also is adjudicated by three. Nigmar adin, once the verdict is reached, iatan rashai litzoa, you are not allowed to then engage in a compromise. That, from what we had said before, Jewish law is different than our regular legal system. Because the matter, once you have submitted it to God's law, and the justices have made their judgment of the application of that law, then it's a matter of law, and you can no longer do something which you might have been able to do before that. Wait, I'm going to keep pushing and go a little further. Rabbi Eliezer benosha Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer. Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi Aglili, says, Asur liftzoa. It is forbidden for a judge to arbitrate a compromise. Yeah. It's astounding here. So obviously he was against it. Now, it's for the very reasons that we've been discussing, right? Everything should be a matter of the application of divine law. Here you're doing something different, according to his point of view. The chol abotzea hareza chote. Any judge who arbitrates a compromise is a sinner. The chol amivarechet abotzea hareza mina eitz. Anyone that praises a judge who arbitrates a compromise is considered a blasphemer. And here he then quotes a verse from the Psalms. Ubotzea berach ni'atz Hashem. Regarding such a person, it is stated, one who praises a compromiser, alzenemar, botzea berech, right? If he praises, he blesses a compromiser, botzea, ni'atz Hashem. He has blasphemed Hashem. Eli Yikov Adim et Ahar. Rather, and here you get to the heart of the matter, let justice pierce the mountain. Right? Justice, this is God's law, shall be the thing that really decides the matter. Shenemar ki amishpat l'Elohim hu. Justice comes from God. Techein Moshe haya omer, and Moses used to say, Yikov hadin et ahar, let justice pierce the mountain. Moses was a man of justice, of divine justice. Aval. But. You get the next one. But. Aharon. His brother Aaron. Ohev shalom, v'rodev shalom. He loved peace, and he pursued peace. Umesim shalom ben adam l'chavero, and he would try to bring peace between one man and his neighbor. Shenemar, Torat emet hayata b'fihu, the true Torah was in his mouth. The avla lo nimtza bisfatav, and iniquity was not found in his lips. B'shalom ubimishor halach iti v'rabim heshib me'avon. He walked with me in peace and uprightness and turned many away from iniquity. So here you have two completely different sides. One personified by Moses, for whom justice is everything, the other one personified by his brother Aaron, who was a pursuer of peace, and of course compromise is the way of Aaron. And you're going to see, we're not going to get to it tonight, you'll see that the Gemara is going to go into a long discussion about Aaron in another page or so, because remember that Aaron was involved in the most problematic historic compromise in the history of Jewish life, which was the golden calf. And was that good or was that bad? And is Aaron a hero or is he a fool? or worse than that, an evil man. I just want to go a little bit further. Right? We started out with this verse, Botzea Berech Ni'etz Hashem. Okay, Botzea Berech, and the first one, the first opinion that we saw was Botzea, a compromiser. Berech, if you bless, praise a compromiser, you have spurned the Lord. Now we've got the Aaron, who we see is a compromiser. If you take that point of view, what do you do with that verse? What do you do with the verse? Here's a different interpretation of the verse. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Harei Shegazal Se'ah Shel Chitim. This is how you understand the verse. If a person steals a se'ah, that's a bushel of wheat, Utechanan, he grinds the wheat, Uve'apa'a, and he bakes it, he frish mi menachala, and then he gives the obligatory amount to the Kohen. Right? Now realize what he's done. He's given a gift to God.
This is stolen wheat.
With stolen wheat. With stolen wheat. Okay? He's given a gift to God with stolen wheat. Ketzad mevarech. How is he able to say a bracha for the challah that he is giving it? When you give challah, you have to say Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Asher Kiddushanu b'mitzvah. How can you make how is it a mitzvah to give a gift which is stolen wheat? Alright? Ein, here you go. Ein ze mevarech ela mena etz. This person is not reciting a blessing, but is blaspheming. He is blaspheming. But alzeh ne'amar, that is why the Psalms say, u'botzeah. Botzeah means, has a totally different meaning. Botzeah can mean somebody who breaks bread. When you say yitza in Hebrew means to break bread. Botzeah yochal rishon. The person who says the motzi and breaks the bread, supposed to eat the bread first. So that botzea can also mean to break bread. So in other words, botzea, when that person breaks bread, ni'etz Hashem, he has spurned the Lord. You are not allowed to bless God as a result of stolen property. Right? If you stolen property, you cannot use that as a reason to bless the Lord. It doesn't make any difference. Makes no difference. You stole it. You stole it.
Yeah, but it was given to the poor and it was left there.
And you stole it from the poor.
No, it wasn't.
And then you didn't steal it. If you didn't steal it, it's a different thing. But we're talking about where you stole.
Okay,
all right, we're talking about where you stole. The point here is just that we have now found another use for the verse. The verse doesn't necessarily mean what we thought it meant first. What we thought it meant first led us to say that compromise is bad. If you take Aaron's point of view and those who follow, like Rabbi Eliezer, in fact, what Aaron did was not bad, but was good. And so we can explain the verse in an entirely different way, as referring to a person who tries to get religious credit for stolen property. Exactly. And that's perfectly good Hebrew. It's perfectly good Hebrew. Right? That's the strength of the Hebrew language. It offers us those interpretive possibilities. One more, just let's finish it up. Okay, the third now we get a third explanation of the verse. Rabbi Meir Omer, Lo ne'amar botzea ela keneged Yehuda. The word botzea really refers to the instance in the Torah of Yehuda. Remember who Yehuda was. That was one of the brothers of Joseph. Okay? And what does Yehuda suggest to the brothers at an early stage of the game? They want to kill their brother. And you remember what he says? He says, no, we don't have to kill him, you never throw him in the hole. Okay? Kashinema Bayoma Yehuda Elechav Ma Betzet Kina Haroget Achenu. Of what betza? We're back to batza again. Of what value is it? What gain will there be if we throw our brother, if we kill our brother? Now, we'll go back to the verse. V'chol ha-mevarechet Yehuda ha-reze minna eitz. Whoever praises Judah for this statement really is spurning the Lord. Why? Because he should have not just said that, but he should have said, it's not nice to do what we want to do. Right? He decides on something that could have killed him anyway. Okay? So, sometimes you seem like you're the good guy, and you're not really quite as good a guy as you seem. And if we praise this overly, then we are really praising actions that are not so good in themselves. quite true. That is true. Okay? Any questions, Tony? Correct. You'll see that this tension now, so we've come really to a tension, which is frankly a wonderful tension, which is the tension between pursuing compromise and the need to adjudicate all matters by law. And we see the two archetypes are Moses and Aaron. And the way we haven't decided anything, but we're living now with the tension between these two.
So
Jesus
does not get credit for having faith?
He may get credit from you or me. I give him credit. In fact, he doesn't get credit at this particular piece of Talmud. Exactly. And to this day, that's an argument that people will have. Not about Yehuda. Whether, when you could have taken a stronger stand, and you took a half stronger stand, were you good? Alright. Matter has not yet been decided. Very good. To be yes?
The notion of a jury is an English construct?
That I can't tell you, but I can tell you it's not a Jewish construct. It doesn't come from the Talmud. Okay? To be continued.
Thank you.
My bets have been in what that of what profit is there in life?